try to catch a stock while it's having a huge move. They like to buy up, pay up, find a stock that's moving like Secretariat, and catch the last 5 furlongs. That's not for me. Not enough reward. Too much risk. Especially given what I know about how a company's stock can diverge substantially from the worth of the underlying company. That's why I am not a chaser. I'm a classic bottom fisher. I try to buy situations where stocks have gone down to some level that to me is just plain wrong, that is totally and unequivocally out of sync with the underlying company the stock represents. When the company's long-term virtues are totally out of whack with the equity. The same goes for the market as a whole. There are moments of sheer lunacy involving the S&P 500, the benchmark index that we all follow, or in the NASDAQ, or even the Dow Jones averages, where these gold standards of investing go awry because of panicky sellers. They can be completely and totally wrong versus how the underlying companies or the economy is really doing. That happens at bottoms. The positive realities separate themselves from the panicked fantasies of bizarre, uneconomical, and irrational closing prices, and you have to pounce when they do. The biggest mistake people make in finding bottoms is that they find too many of them and find them too often. The bottoms I am talking about are rare, rare and dramatic. True long-lasting bottoms just don't occur every day or every month or even every quarter. They occur just often enough to make the patient rich and to reward the out-of-favor buyer. My bottoms are what I call mega bottoms. These are the kinds of bottoms that you brag about getting for years. The kind that occur after vicious and often wildly exaggerated declines. The kind that happen when a stock seems permanently damaged, even as the company underneath is suffering no more than a scant hiccup. My work on the topic is the result of examining and studying thousands of true bottoms that I have called, and some that I have missed, in both the stock market and in individual stocks. When you invest in these kinds of bottoms, you don't have to be nearly as worried about all the other things that I caution and counsel about in this book. You can stay a bull for a while. You have a longer time to wait until you become a pig. You have gigantic leeway to let your gain run. That's the best kind of gain, and one that can make up for a lot of losers. I divide the patterns into two kinds of bottoms, investment bottoms and trading bottoms. Trading bottoms don't last, but are so juicy. And in these days of low commissions and instant trading, so obtainable that I don't want you to miss them. Investment bottoms, however, are long-lasting, and you can get in some fantastic prices for discretionary savings or retirement. Some coincide with overall bottoms of the stock market itself. In the past 20 years, we have seen 4 market bottoms of consequence. The 1987 crash, the 1990 Iraq-Kuwait bottom, the 1998 long-term capital bottom, and the 2002-2003 post-dot-com pre-second Iraq war bottom. All 4 of these bottoms were exquisite moments to buy because if you nailed them, if you kept some cash on the sidelines for them and applied it correctly, or if you went all into equities at these moments, you beat the vast majority of managers and made fortunes for yourself or your investors. There were many other false bottoms during this study period, but none of them measured up in terms of opportunities worth committing that excess capital aggressively into the market. What mattered in each case was that indicators reached extremes that told you it was safe to land your capital. I have studied these bottoms intensively, both as a participant and as an historian. They each had one-of-a-kind characteristics, but not enough to make the study of them useless and non-predictive. They had so many readily observable commonalities that these bottoms are, in retrospect, discernible and investable. And most important, worth waiting for. Every bottom is caused by different events. In the 1987 bottom, which occurred the day after the crash of 1987, a series of mergers and acquisitions took place as corporate America recognized that the monstrous 22% sell-off didn't foreshadow any economic downturn and was more a matter of computerized program trading run amok. The 1990 bottom occurred after Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, which led to a dramatic decline in the price of oil after an initial spike. The 1998 decline got staunched, ostensibly, because of a cut in interest rates by the Fed. The 2002-2003 double bottom, October 2002 and February 2003, occurred with the run-up to and start of the Iraqi war. Let's examine what all four of these market bottoms had in common. What had to happen in each case before the stock market could stop going down? All of this information is readily accessible, by the way, through reading a combination of the USA Today, the New York Times, Investor's Business Daily, and the Wall Street Journal. If that's too time-consuming, I constantly update this stuff during the trying periods in thestreet.com. 1. Market sentiment. Sentiment's a tough thing to gauge. There are tons of anecdotal indicators and services that produce bottom calls, but I find them dubious because they tend to be without long-term significance. We are, in the end, measuring pain, and when the pain gets to the maximum, we are going to get a bottom, which was the case in all four of our mega bottoms of the last 20 years. That said, here's my sentiment psychology checklist of what must occur before we can be sure that a bottom might be at hand. Until you see every one of these indicators, you would be nuts to commit any excess capital to the market. First, the pain makes the front page of the New York Times. This indicator, one of the absolute favorites of Mrs. Cramer, has literally never been wrong. Such a simple thing, but it is worth considering why it works so well. First, the supposition here is that during the periods of incredible pain, there are always people who show up in the business sections of your newspaper, in the business magazine press, and of course on business TV, saying that a bottom is at hand. For the most part, those who say these things are pushing an agenda. Maybe they run a mutual fund, and that fund can't short. It's therefore always a good time to invest in that firm. Maybe they run a brokerage business that makes its money in commissions. And the worst thing that can happen is to say, I wouldn't buy now. Given that most of the profits from equities come from writing buy tickets, chiefly of underwritings, where the sales fee is much bigger than anything that could be gotten on the sell side, the notion of trusting any of these people is simply preposterous. Nor does it help to read in the business section of the New York Times or the green money section of USA Today, the two most important papers when it comes to calling a bottom, that there is a lot of blood on the streets or that the pain is getting too great. Those are classic canards too. In my research on bottoms, I found dozens of articles about pain and losses in these sections that were written before some of the biggest parts of the declines occurred. But all bearish bets are off when the New York Times, or USA Today, puts the market's pain in a prominent place on the front page of their papers. Amazingly, at every bottom, stories about how horrid the market is have become a staple. If the market woes stories aren't on the front page, then simply wait. The bottom hasn't been reached yet. It is simply incredible how right this indicator always is. A second gauge of sentiment that has never been wrong and has snared all four of these mega bottoms is the Investors Intelligence Survey of Money Managers. Again, like the New York Times indicator, it is a contraindicator, a counterintuitive sign that will make sense only after you understand the dynamics of the poll. For 20 years, Investors Intelligence, a nationwide service, has questioned newsletter writers about whether they are bullish or bearish. While you might expect that a good time to invest is when the managers are bullish, that's actually the worst time to invest. Anyone who answers the poll by saying he is bullish is admitting that he likes the market. If he likes the market, he is by definition already in and invested. It therefore stands to reason that if everybody's bullish, then everyone spent his cash and bought his stock. Which is why the single most important sentiment indicator I follow after the front page New York Times indicator is when a majority of money managers polled dislike the market. When the bull-bear ratio shows a definitive majority of bears, or even a plurality of bears with less than 40% bulls, you are in the safety sentiment zone. Mind you, a reading alone of less than 40% bulls doesn't per se mean a bottom. But remember, this is a checklist. And this is one of the most important indicators to hold out for to be sure you are not getting a false reading. For those unfamiliar with this indicator, it can be found among all of the indicators in the Investor's Business Daily and is available every Thursday morning in the paper. Never buck it. Doing so has cost me tens of millions of dollars. Why should you lose money after I have proven that the losses always occur when you anticipate the bull bear percentages too soon? The third and one of the meanest indicators is one of the best: mutual fund withdrawals. No important bottom is without these. No bottom is sustainable without mutual fund flows occurring steadily for at least 2 months. There can always be periods of 1 or 2 or even 3 weeks where you might get outflows related either to tax concerns or to unusual events that scare people. But consistent, repeated outflows of several months in duration accompany all the big bottoms. These numbers, available on Fridays through an organization called AMG, are almost always in the papers Saturday or Monday. So again, we are not talking about esoteric, hard-to-find data. If you haven't seen big outflows, again, you aren't there yet. Perhaps the most esoteric of my sentiment indicators, and the only one that isn't readily accessible in your local paper, is the fourth indicator, the VIX. The VIX, or Volatility Index, is a measure of stress in the system. It is a compilation of worry, as defined by various ratios of puts and calls that gauge either complacency or panic. Panic signals the freakout selling that always accompanies market bottoms. A reading above 40 in the VIX, a measure of pure panic in the marketplace, indicates a market bottom. In fact, anything above 35 can trigger a possible bottom, but plus 40 is a requirement that all four of our significant bottoms have met. Any reading below 30 indicates that the bottom can't be trusted. When I first heard the word oscillator, I said to myself, now here's some genuine Wall Street gibberish, some indicator that tells you whether stocks are oversold or not. How could some indicator that tabulates how eager people are to unload stocks by measuring how many sales occur on downticks and at distressed levels really help you identify a bottom? But as someone who daily measures the overbought, oversold condition through the columns of TheStreet.com's Helene Meisler, someone who I believe is the world's number one technician, I have come to respect this instrument to the point that I never buck it, ever, when calling a bottom. It is my fifth bottom indicator. Most of the time, markets are in equilibrium. Buyers buy at reasonable levels relative to the last buy, and sellers sell at reasonable levels relative to the last sale. But at times, market players en masse are so exuberant that they push up prices constantly with their buying. They don't wait for supply and demand to be in balance, and they chase stocks up, causing higher prices. Likewise, there are moments when sellers want out so badly that they will not wait for buyers to step up to the plate. They seek out the buyers wherever they can find them, chiefly well below prevailing levels. Oscillators measure these pressures. Equilibrium buying occurs when an oscillator registers in the middle, which is defined by -2 to 0 or 0 to +2. A +2 reading or a -2 reading signifies nothing. Only extremes matter. At every negative extreme, defined as -5 or lower, we have gotten a terrific opportunity to buy stocks. All four of the bottoms I have researched gave us extreme readings of -7 before they bottomed. The oscillator indicator, unlike the VIX, is something that produces almost instant results. The bottom is in when you get that reading, along with all of the others that I have described here. If you get all of these, a -7 reading on the oscillator, a +35 reading or more on the VIX for 3 weeks, sustained mutual fund withdrawals, a reading of 40 bulls or fewer in the Investors Intelligence Survey, and a front page story in the New York Times or USA Today detailing the pain the market is causing the man in the street, you will have satisfied the sentiment indicator for a mega bottom. It sounds so simple, but in reality, using these indicators is an exercise in extreme patience. I can't tell you how many times people have called me during the last 4 years and said, "It's so painful, we must be near a bottom." And I have to go over the checklist and disabuse them about where we really are. Usually they say, "That's okay, I can hold out." But I will let you in on a secret. Nobody, not even the trading goddess, can take the amount of pain that has to occur in a swing from euphoria to a swing of despair. That's why if you are feeling the tightening around your throat or the knots in your stomach, and we are nowhere near negative on the oscillator or near super bearish on the Investor's Intelligence, I recommend that you trim your holdings back, perhaps dramatically. That's what I usually advise people who call into my radio program. 2. Capitulation. The next set of indicators that we must see before we can call an investable bottom gauge capitulation. In every one of these mega bottoms, we had what I describe as a crescendo sell-off before we had an exquisite moment. In a crescendo sell-off, we have massive capitulation. Players who had been hoping to stay with the market finally give up and can't take the pain anymore. A crescendo bottom is a bottom where a great many sellers converge at once to take stocks down to unusual levels versus the fundamentals. The associated detail that has marked all crescendo sell-offs is a dramatic imbalance in the amount of new highs to new lows. At all of the bottoms that I have found to be investable, you have between 400 and 700 new lows and only a handful of new highs. That kind of capitulation is a must-have before you can be sure that the majority of selling is over. When you have only a couple of hundred new lows, not enough damage has been done to reach a buyable crescendo. Another telltale sign of capitulation involves the flow of underwritings. Brokerage houses live by the selling of merchandise through underwritings. It is second in profitability to merger and acquisition work, and the lifeblood of many of the larger sales houses. Because it is so important, firms will push these deals through the door no matter what, until there are simply no more buyers left. At that point, at last, they stop, because if they can't sell the deals, they get stuck with the merchandise. They won't bring a new set of deals until they have worked off the old merchandise. That means the excess inventory has at last been worked off in the system, and the all clear has been sounded. There's too much cash idle again at last. That's why underwritings are such a perfect test of when a bottom might be coming. 3. Catalyst. The ultimate goal when you spot crescendo selling and you match it with the sentiment indicators is to consider what event could occur that would trigger what I call an exquisite moment where you have to buy because the opportunity is so great. In 1991, at the end of a 7-month bear market, and in 2003, at the end of a 3-year bear market, we got the exact same catalyst, the start of a war with Iraq. In both cases, we had a pretty high degree of confidence about when the event would occur. In both cases, as is often the case with what I call the big bad event syndrome, where a news event that so dwarfs others is about to occur, the stock market factored in all the negatives and none of the positives. In 1998, the catalyst that triggered the upsurge was a surprise federal funds cut. I say surprise because the Federal Reserve let some of its buddies that talked to the press have a heads up that the rate cut was going to occur. That was the signal to jolt stocks upward. In 1987, the catalyst was again the Fed, which, when it saw all the delayed openings in stocks, said it would provide all the liquidity needed to make sure the markets were orderly. Again, after each sell-off, a different trigger will cause the averages to reverse. The trick is to recognize ahead of time whether enough of the precursors are in place so that you are prepared when the catalyst comes to change the direction. The trick is not to know or to try to predict the catalyst itself. That's rarely known. But the setup for the exquisite moment can be predicted much more easily than the actual trigger that pushes the market higher. Think of it ultimately as a forest fire waiting to happen. The seller's inventory, the liquid that keeps the forest damp, has run dry. Then you know that the tinder is ready, and the exquisite moment is about to strike. You don't need to know when or where the spark will come from to know that things are ready to ignite. One other consideration. Sometimes the bottoms are so vicious and elusive that you need to test the waters first so you don't get too exposed to the market before it really bottoms and collapses again. For that, may I suggest something that has kept losses to a minimum when I am market bottom fishing? Start your buys on the morning of the bottom, not with your favorites, but with some stocks that might have additional support from day traders and institutions. Buy the stocks that have been upgraded that morning. If the market does falter, the artificial buying that comes with every upgrade will at least cushion the downside for the stocks you are using to test. Don't leave it to chance or buy a stock that has no institutional support that day. You may end up in an equity that gets slammed if the market reverses down sharply, and you will be too shell-shocked to attempt the next bottom. And bottoms, real bottoms, are too precious not to try for. You can use that method to test every single bottom and never have to pay so much as a ticket for admission. It's a terrific way to feel for a bottom with minimum pain. Believe it or not, bottoms on individual stocks are a lot harder to call than market bottoms. That's because divining the behavior of a single entity is much more difficult than trying to fathom thousands of equities that in many ways do trade together. Still, there are some telltale signs you can use to spot them. You just have to remember what you are looking for, the pricing in of the negatives without any of the positives being included. Let me give you my checklist of what to look for to detect a bottom in an individual stock. First, a stock needs to lose most, if not all, of its sponsorship to form a true bottom. Even in the tough market of 2004, with just a handful of winners, it is amazing to see that in each winner's case, it didn't bottom and then begin to move up until it lost most, if not all, of its sponsorship. Amazon, Yahoo, and eBay, together among the best acting stocks in the market, each received multiple downgrades and were even the recipients of sell recommendations at the bottom. That's a classic tell when a stock loses whatever support it has left on Wall Street. The bad news about spotting the sells is that it might take several quarters for the turn to occur because the analysts won't get back on the horse until it has a couple of good quarters. They've been too burned to be anything but twice shy. The good news is that when everyone has downgraded a stock and it has a decent balance sheet, your downside is extremely limited. The most dangerous thing that can occur is that you might end up sitting out of whatever rally you might be trying to play. They can't hurt you with any more downgrades. They've already occurred. A second tell of a bottom occurs when bad news hits and the stock ceases to go down. This indicator is a simple one, and it is common in every single bottom. That's because bottoms get formed only when all the sellers have finished, so there's no one left who cares about the new negatives to want to dump stocks. Again, remember, this works only with a good balance sheet, because with a bad one, the bad news could lead to some sort of impairment that removes the equity from your hands and puts it in the hands of the bond or note holders. A third indicator is consistent large insider buying. Insiders sell for a myriad of reasons. Taxes, estate planning, divorce, prudence. They buy for only one reason, to make money. Beware here, though. The managements know they can draw attention to their companies with token buying or with widespread but small buying by all board members. This kind of forced buying shouldn't fool you. Don't bite when you see small dollar amounts of buying by individuals at the top. They could be painting the tape with their buys. You need to see buys in the millions of dollars to be sure that someone isn't trying to trick you into the stock or con some reporter. Buy only when you see multiple buys too. There's always one board member with a lot of cash around. But multiple and repeat buyers of significant amounts shows you the insiders mean business. It's a great tell and often signals the absolute bottom in an enterprise's stock. A fourth indicator of a bottom occurs when a stock is rumored upon negatively and nothing happens. At all times, there are plenty of hedge funds that need merchandise to go lower so they can bring in their shorts, either successfully or unsuccessfully. At all times, there are also unscrupulous people who are willing to say anything about a company to anybody, especially the press, to knock the price down, knowing that it will be repeated by willing brokers who want the short seller's business. For most of you, this process seems completely insidious. You think it is outrageous that short sellers plant rumors and tell tall tales to knock stock prices down. Not for me. I am always looking for all clear signs to beat the system. I regard it as the ultimate tell of a stock going from weak to strong hands when I hear a negative rumor about the company broadcast widely, either through a network or a national newspaper, a website, or a magazine. And the stock, which most likely would have been totaled by the rumor at a higher price, does nothing. So, I like to keep up on the negatives of stocks that have been breaking down to figure out when all the negative news is in. That usually means some positive news is about to come down the pike or the major damage is done and you are safe to speculate on a bottom. The final kind of bottoms I look for are bottoms based on macro considerations. These are sector rotation bottoms, and they are the key to making unusually large profits. These bottoms involve decisions by big money to make moves to get out of some stocks that have been very hot and into others that have been very cold, almost entirely because of macro decisions like Fed tightening or loosening policies. There is a simple theme to these rotations. When you believe that the tightenings are beginning to have an effect, you will see a sudden rush of money over a 4 or 5 day period into the Kellogg's, Avon's, Procter's, and Kimberly's, the stuff that is in your kitchen and your medicine chest. I used to like to place these bets close to the midway point in the tightening portion of the cycle. But these days, so many people anticipate the Fed's moves that I think you would be best to start buying right at the time of the first tightening. Usually, you get the tightening after a prolonged period of inflation, which erodes the value of these key franchises. But when the Fed tightens, you get a freeze in the economy and the erosion stops. Also, when the Fed tightens, you get a fear that the cyclical companies will not make their numbers the following year, or that the future will be clouded for the companies that are heavily dependent upon the economy. Of course, the opposite happens when the Fed does its first loosening. Traditionally, you need to switch into a sector that does well with the economy. typically companies like the autos and the retailers. You rotate into the heavier cyclicals as the easings go on. Until in the end, you are stuck with the dirtiest of stocks out there, such as steel, copper, and aluminum. I point all this out not to belabor something discussed earlier, but to point out that throughout these periods, brokers and TV pundits and the mutual fund folk will be recommending the cheap food and drug stocks betting on a comeback right in the middle of an economic expansion or when they have just started selling off. Think to yourself, false bottom. Same with the cyclicals. You like the cyclicals when they are most expensive, when their earnings have cratered, when they traditionally seem outrageously overvalued. But when their multiples are cheap, when you hear that Phelps Dodge trades at 6 times next year's earnings, run for the hills. It will never make that number. It might not even make half of that. That's the slowdown coming. Never be lulled into cyclical stocks when they are cheap. Sell the safety stocks when they are ultra expensive. Their bottoms are both counterintuitively reached and formed by the Fed cycle, not by their intrinsic earnings power. Two great investment themes create the day-to-day tension in the stock market: capital appreciation and capital preservation. We have historically, and I think inaccurately, called capital appreciation by a different name, buy and hold. I have shown that buy and hold has no place in the logical investing lexicon, and that buy and homework must be the modus operandi. Buy and hold presumes, preposterously, that tops, permanent impairment of stocks after a certain attained height, don't exist. Yet dozens of tops are formed every week that could wipe out whatever capital appreciation you may have gained by buying and holding. Tops are the bane of all investing. At a top, buy and hold is the enemy, and capital preservation becomes king. For me, spotting a top is the equivalent of embarking on a long and winding train ride and trying to figure out if the engine's about to jump the tracks anytime soon. We know nearly all trains get to their destinations, yet we accept the fact that occasional derailments do happen. You want to get as much mileage out of a stock as possible, but not so much that you hang on while the stock jumps the track or plummets through a broken trestle. Sometimes you got to jump off the train to survive. It's no sin to do so. And of course, it would be pretty stupid if you knew a crash was coming and you stuck around for it. I have spent much of my life poring over chart books looking for patterns, looking for repetitive warning signs that would get you out before the top. I wanted to find a commonality or a set of commonalities that could be warning bells for stocks that would otherwise be too dangerous to touch. The stocks that produce short-term gains in almost parabolic style. The stocks that go up fast but fall even faster. The idea behind such reasoning is that you shouldn't deny yourself an iVillage or a Commerce One or an eBay on the way up, provided you know when to get out. You can own the sizzling stocks, take the huge gains that they provide, and then exit before the stake gets burned. Spotting tops allows you to embrace lots more equities, including riskier ones that can be very rewarding. Much more rewarding than most people think possible. If you hone your selling skills, you can take advantage of the 4- and 5-fold rallies that can occur in unseasoned merchandise, even if, in the end, the merchandise craters to zero, as long as it does so without you on board. Stocks require flexibility. You may have to like a stock 1 minute and hate it the next, because the fundamentals underneath change that fast. If you think this is a business of firm, resolute stands, no matter what the facts say, you are going to end up poor as a church mouse. That's no way to run money, your own or others. Let me give you a couple of other caveats to the top process. First, this is not about spotting market tops. I am focusing on when to sell individual stocks, although I reach a conclusion about the entire market and when it should be sold, more as a recognition that there have been and will be tops in the S&P 500 that will last long enough that they should be solidified. Second, I am not a technician, and this is not a collection of chart patterns that leads up to tops. Chart people spot many tops. In fact, they spot many more tops than there are. That's just not valuable to me. In fact, one of the biggest mistakes I ever had in my career was to be short Genentech based on a classic top formation, which a prominent technician told me 99 times out of 100 produced a significant decline. I got my face handed to me when the next week Genentech got a humongous takeover bid. I had to buy the stock back up about 70%. Nasty, embarrassing, and astonishingly costly. As I hung up on the technician after cussing him out for the hot tip, he was squealing, "But the chart says it should go down!" To heck with the chart! To heck with the chartists! Except Mrs. Kramer, who still manages to integrate the fundies and accepts that the chart can never be the final judgment, but can be consulted to generate ideas. Nor am I talking about temporary fluctuations in stocks, avoiding short-term drops. If you follow my rules on portfolio management, my bulls, bears, and pigs mantra that involves taking a little something off the table as the stock goes up, these short-term tops, false tops, so to speak, take care of themselves. You quickly put the money back to work in the same equity at a lower, cooler level. Low taxes and low transaction costs now allow such moves. This kind of approach not only is important, it is prudent in a world gone buy and hold haywire. No, I am addressing here the basic reasons why, unfortunately, at times, you should abandon stocks you know and love. They are reasons why you should take the money off the table and look elsewhere for opportunity because something has changed. Something in the landscape, either for the equity or the company itself, has gone sour or is about to go sour, and very few people know it. Here are the main antagonists to buy and hold. The place where tops are in sight, and you can assume that the train will derail if you stay along for the ride. 1. Competition. The most common form of top explains why you must stay involved with the day-to-day operations of your companies, why you can't do buy and hold, but have to do homework instead. The competitive top, when someone else comes in and destroys your company's business. You can tell when the competition is heating up only if you stay vigilant and monitor not just your company, but the whole industry. One of the main reasons why I say you need to give your portfolio 1 hour a week per position if you're going to get it right. 70% of the tops I have studied have this dominant competitive characteristic at their roots. Typically, the company itself doesn't see it coming. You may own a company with fairly decent margins on sales that is forecasting great multi-year visibility because it has terrific market share and has vanquished its competitors. Suddenly, a new entrant comes in, one who can make the same product or do the same service or sell the same goods as your company, but with lower margins. The new competitor, if it means business, and they often do, will destroy your company even as your company pretends that such a thing can't happen or doesn't even know that a competitor is lurking because it is watching only the existing players, not anyone off the radar screen. 2. Vagueness. Whenever a management is vague about specifics, whenever a management tells you it isn't worried about the numbers, or that it doesn't want to be constrained by the projections or by the forecasts because it is talking and thinking about bigger things, sell the stock. There are no bigger things than the numbers. This is not a game of trying to make people feel better or making them more broad-minded. This is not a liberal arts bull session. It's a business of hitting the numbers. When management goes vague in an interview, any interview, run for the hills. You've got a real top on your hands. Spotting this type of top can be done only if you do the homework and read about the companies that you own. You have to search for the interviews and watch them when they come on television, just to see whether they are shucking and jiving or they are sticking by the hard facts. Vagueness, like competition, is something that you can find out about only if you are paying attention and are benchmarking the company. If you don't listen to the conference calls and don't read the interviews or articles, how will you know about new competition? And how will you know when management's gone vague? The chart sure as heck won't tell you. Only vigilance will get you out before the top strikes when management has gone opaque. 3. Overexpansion. Nothing defeats a company's dreams like overexpansion. I have said throughout this program that growth is all that matters. In the end, if you can't create growth organically, you either have to buy growth or you have to use steroids to grow. Knowing when a company is overexpanding and expanding too quickly, the functional equivalent of steroids, is integral to spotting a top ahead of a train wreck. Unfortunately, overexpansion is inherently difficult to analyze. It is tough to spot because Wall Street doesn't want you to spot it. Wall Street masks the problems of too much growth. That's because Wall Street loves acquisitions and rapid expansion, the primary ways to make quick growth happen. Acquisitions can make for instant growth, but they can also make for instant problems. Frenetic store openings or office expansions strain a young management's attention and dollars. Both are catastrophic to the core enterprise unless checked by some degree of common sense, as well as the wisdom to stand up to the growth jihadists who populate mutual and hedge funds. Often, companies do acquisitions to please analysts who are working hand in glove with another department at their firm that does mergers and acquisitions work. An investment house makes more money doing M&A than any other activity. But the babe in the woods managements that come to Wall Street don't know that. They want to please the analysts. The analysts want payback from bonuses that are controlled by the hierarchy. And the hierarchy knows nothing generates fees like M&A. The investment bankers want to do the deal. Any deal. All deals. If a company cannot grow numbers fast enough on Wall Street, it has to go by the numbers or succumb to downgrades. And those are often too much for unseasoned managements to recover from. The integration of the takeovers, though, is something so difficult, so taxing, that even the pros screw it up. Time and time again, after a company makes an acquisition, the analysts dutifully raise numbers and the stocks initially go higher. I almost always sell into that hoopla because the acquisitions don't go smoothly in most cases. And the numbers come down when they don't. What's the sell signal here if you can't pull the trigger when the numbers go higher? I will give you the code. Whenever you hear management talk about integration problems, as in integration problems are slowing our ability to merge these two entities, run, don't walk, to the exit. All deals have integration problems. They are given. If they are affecting the numbers to the point that management has to acknowledge them, believe me, that's fatal. The ultimate top is formed when a company stumbles after breakneck expansion, any company. Don't even attempt to bottom fish. There tends to be no there, especially when the expansion is of the roll-up variety, where the home office keeps issuing stock to buy mom-and-pop companies. Once the earnings cool and the stock flops, there's no way to get the momentum back. No mom-and-pop will sacrifice its hard-earned businesses for that devalued currency. The street is littered with bankrupt companies that didn't understand that ironclad law. 4. Government blindside. The front page of the New York Times spots more tops than the business page. That's because governments, both federal and state, can do more to hurt companies or permanently debilitate their earnings than any competitor. Oddly, though, the Wall Street analysts who are supposed to flag the real problems for companies to us mortals who await their verdicts don't pay much attention to government edicts. The large institutions that control the marginal shares of companies are so focused on earnings growth from internal sources that they, too, miss the big negatives that can come from any administration. In the late 1990s, for example, the greatest stocks, the most recession-proof stocks, were the nursing home stocks. These had momentum and a thesis, the graying of America. All of the major investment houses embraced the aging theme, and everyone presumed that the government would just keep paying major portions of the nursing home bills for the elderly. Wasn't that the politically popular position? Didn't the elderly control lots of key states and vote their pocketbooks? That was the logic, certainly, of the lofty multiples these stocks sold at in the late 1990s. Perhaps the most popular stock of the era, Genesis Health Ventures, a gigantic East Coast nursing home chain that kept issuing stock to roll up mom-and-pop nursing homes, just kept roaring and roaring higher as this thesis ascended. But President Clinton, right before the turn of the century, decided he had to rein in some healthcare costs lest the country slip back into deficit spending. The feds decided, virtually out of nowhere, to change the reimbursement rate to operators of nursing homes. The companies didn't see it coming. The analysts didn't see it coming. Yet when it happened, it was devastating news delivered from the front page of the New York Times. I recently looked up the first call notes, the analysts' contemporaneous comments, and not one flagged the articles that were hidden in plain sight on the front page of the paper of record. They all missed it. This reimbursement change was the single most devastating piece of news ever, but the stocks just hung there as the owners and their analyst buddies ignored the guillotine that slammed down on the news pages. Once the reimbursement rates changed, every one of these companies went from great longs to great shorts overnight. Genesis Health, the bellwether of the industry, the gold standard, would be in bankruptcy within a year. It went bankrupt while many of the buy recommendations were still intact. How do you spot this kind of top? You have to start by reading the front pages, not just the business sections, of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, and the Washington Post. I start my day with them electronically, inserting my stock's names in their indices to see where the articles come up. I never constrain myself to the business sections. That's just foolish. 5. Top in retail. Retail tops are easy to spot. Some think you can spot them by measuring same-store sales, sales that are compared on an apples-to-apples basis. If sales in one store were $1 million in year one and $900,000 in year two, that's a same-store sales decline of 10% for that store. I like that as a measure of rapid-growing retailers, but for mature retailers, I use a different litmus test. Companies have good months and bad, and while the same-store sales are important, they inconsistently call more tops than they should. False tops are the bane of investors who own retailers, so you have to be very careful not to exit just because a company, especially an apparel company, had a bad month. No, the real top in retail comes when a retailer has stores in every state, when there are no new areas in which to expand. Every retailer, whether it be Gap or Walmart or Kohl's or Home Depot or The Limited or Toys R Us, hits a wall when that happens. I love to own retailers earlier in their growth cycle, when they are regional going national, lots of states ahead, and if the concept is a good one, you can use every single same-store sales decline to buy more. But, and it is a huge but, once all the locations are used up, as represented by a truly national presence, I have no desire ever to own that retailer again. It's been a terrific way to own these stocks, and I have managed to get the maximum out of every one of the majors and then leave them, never to own them again, when they cracked into the last corners and crannies of American malls. Be careful. Analysts hate to get off retail horses while they are running. They will deny that this nationwide test matters. I know better. It works every time. 6. Fad stock tops. I can't blame anyone for playing any fad. The runs we have had in everything from Reebok to Palm to Research in Motion have been fantastic. There's always a product out there that is in short supply because it has caught the fancy of the American consumer. You can make fortunes as the stocks go higher, but as soon as the supply catches up to demand, whether it be iPods built by Apple Computer or aerobic sneakers made by Reebok, you must sell it and never look back. How do you spot a fad top? You have to monitor the stores that sell the product. You have to listen to the conference calls. I was able to sell fads at the top in everything from Palms to Fila's to Guess Jeans to Keds simply by listening to the conference calls of places that sell these goods, not by the managements of the companies themselves, who never saw the tops coming. As long as the merchant said they couldn't get enough of the product, I knew I was fine and the stock would go higher. Once they said that they had enough product to be able to meet the demand, there was no price at which I wouldn't sell the supplying company's stock. It's just that simple. 7. In the hole secondary. One of the incredibly easy tops to spy is when a company does a deep-in-the-hole secondary after a huge run. Talk about sure tops. When a company sells stock that is at a huge discount to the last sale of its equity, that's a gigantic red flag that will soon turn into the Jolly Roger to steal your gains. At one time in the 1990s, iOmega developed a cult following. It had a zip drive that people thought was proprietary and was always going to be in short supply. The iOmegans worshipped the stock. Me? I don't worship any stock. But I recognize that a cult following can be milked for all it's worth. Investors and friends would chastise me, saying that it was simply a piece of junk that was overly loved. I said, so what? The stock is in tight supply. The short sellers are killing themselves over it. And I am riding it until I see a secondary that is priced in the hole for it. Meaning a piece of merchandise from insiders at the company that is sold by underwriters at a substantial discount to the last sale. When that happens, you sell, period, and you never look back. That's because the insiders know the jig is up. The real institutional buyers, the smart guys, have no appetite for the merchandise. Voila! Immediately after the short squeeze is alleviated, the chart goes bad, the institutions puke it up, and the stock just dies. That's exactly what happened in iOmega. The stock went from $1 to $50 and then came down to $40, where iOmega priced a secondary at $35. Okay, I didn't get out of $50, but I was able to hit that $35 bid provided by the underwriters who foolishly tried to support the stock. What a home run! Another few months and it would have been a strikeout. 8. Accounting mayhem. The final top that manifests itself with frequency is the accounting shenanigans, Top. The main reason a company jiggers the numbers is that it can't make them. When a company can't make its estimates and resorts to these kinds of games, whether the company is Tyco or Cardinal Health or Bristol Myers or Enron or Shearing Plow, you simply must sell it. There is no excuse, no justification to hold on to it. I have a sign that says, "Accounting irregularities equals sell," on my quote machine. 9. Holland Tunnel Diner Top. We have whole markets that are like the griddle in a diner, where the market is just so darn red hot that you have to take something off the heat or get burned. Sometimes that will cause you to lose some of a good stock that keeps going higher. Other times it will allow you to avoid a top or lessen exposure to a stock that has topped. Unlike the other tops, of course, it is more of a look and feel than a set measure. But when a red-hot market is coupled with an S&P oscillator reading of plus 5 or more, and there are more than 50% bulls, you better believe the merchandise is going to fry. Holland Tunnel Diner Tops are often followed by 7 to 10% declines that the market eventually recovers from. But you would be amazed at how many stocks top for good during those viciously heated moments. Don't let your portfolio be cooked with them. When I got out of the market in March 2000, I was heavily criticized because I had been so bullish just a few weeks before. But tops are like that. Right before you reach the summit, things are cooking to perfection, and you want to be in. You have to be in to get those great gains. But one moment passed, and you have lethally overstayed your welcome. Don't be afraid to change your mind. This is one place where when the heat is too hot, you must get out of the kitchen. Epilogue. My chief motivation for writing this book was to get you to understand that there are always opportunities to make money, always bull markets to find, always stocks that will go higher, even in the crummiest of markets. I think the pendulum has swung too far now, that as silly as it might have been to check our net worth by the minute on the web, it might even be sillier and more dangerous to do nothing with your money today. Retirement's always around the corner. Your paycheck isn't big enough, and it won't last forever. You can't sell your house without buying something else to live in, and that makes the wealth of your house impossible to tap without a dramatic change in circumstance. That's why I know it is time for you to get back in. This time, though, because you will use the principles and common sense of this program, it won't end the way it did at the turn of the last century. In fact, it won't end at all. By no means am I saying it is easy. I insist on buys only with homework. I insist on staying on top of your portfolio. I demand that if you're going to buy individual stocks, you get involved and stay involved. And that if you don't have the time or the inclination, you must hand it off to others. I know, though, without a doubt, that you have to learn to be either a better investor or a better client. There is no other choice. So go build that portfolio. Take your time this time. Do it right. Do it with caution. Approach it with the same thought you would give any large dollar purchase. Live by the rules here. Recognize that your rules and your discipline are your only friends in a world where the government can't protect you from the rapacious folks who we now know dominated the boardrooms of both Main Street and Wall Street. You will make mistakes. You will lose some money. You might not become a millionaire overnight, as so many charlatans in my business claim at seminars and in books. but you will be doing it the way the real pros do. The ones who beat the markets. All markets. The ones who know that you don't have to have a bull market in all stocks to make money. I can't ask you to love stocks as much as I do. But I can ask you to take care of yourself financially because, alas, no one will ever care as much about your money as you. Get started towards saving. Today! Unlike so many things in life, you will never regret it. And one day, I hope, you will look back and think, "Holy cow! I can't believe how much money I was able to make just when everyone else thought that stocks would never, ever work again."
Jim Cramer's Real Money was written and read by James J. Cramer. It was abridged for audio by Jesse Boggs. Editing and post-production by Common Mode. Paul Fowley, Technical Director. The associate producer was Michael Noble. Jim Cramer's Real Money was produced and directed by Paul Fowley. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.